You're listening to Toronto's number one real estate podcast, powered by Watson Estates. The most successful local real estate investing starts right here, right now. Here's your host, broker, investor, and social media influencer, Bradley Watson.
Hey investors, Bradley here from Watson Estates, and you're listening to the largest, fastest growing podcast for Toronto real estate on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. As you know, we love to study the market and we do that, but at the same time, we want to learn and grow as investors in the GTA. So today, for hundreds of episodes we've done, we have not had a lawyer on our show. Today is the day. We have Hussein Kudrati come on from HSK Law Firm in Burlington. He's not just a lawyer, he is also an investor, which is semi-rare in the real estate community that you have a lawyer that's also heavily invested in real estate. And so he has the experience and he has the history and the ability to teach us the things like pitfalls, succession planning, tax planning, and how to structure your deals, whether you're doing your first one or maybe you're 20 deals in. A lot of advanced tips as well. So there's a little bit for everybody here today. I know I learned some stuff and hopefully you do too. If you could, please hit that like button, leave us a review on iTunes, whatever it takes, and comments. I love when we have guests like this because comments are welcome and are responded to by myself and our guest today, who is Hussein. Enjoy the show. Hussein, thank you for joining us on the show. How you doing?
I'm well, Bradley. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you today.
I'm thrilled. We are over, 250 plus episodes, and you are the first lawyer that we have on the show to talk to some of our listeners. And as we were kind of chatting before we got started here, I kind of filled you in on what our listener looks like. We have a lot of investors, a lot of people thinking on how to scale their business or just get started. I think there's no better time than to get started. And I know you have a wealth of information. So I would love it if you could introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your backstory and how you've kind of found yourself and what you specialize in real estate.
Sure. So I'm a lawyer. I practice out of Burlington. I started my own firm in January of this year. Before that, I was with a boutique firm in Burlington for 4 years. And I was born and raised in Mombasa, Kenya. And through my life journey, I've ended up living in Stony Creek and working in Burlington, as I said. And I come from a family that's always believed investing in land as a form of wealth creation. It's been instilled in me for multi-generations at this point. And part of what I like to do is I like to work with investors in my practice because they're the kinds of people who I can relate to. And honestly, I view it as not just being a lawyer. It's about making friendships, building relationships. That's what I view this role and this path I'm on. And it's fantastic to be in Southwest Ontario at this time because the market is booming. Everyone wants to get involved. And honestly, now with the competitiveness, building relationships and guiding people to scaling and leveling up in a competitive market is what gets my juices flowing. And I love what I do because of it.
I can tell. I'm curious. So what aspects of real estate have you invested? And maybe tell us a little bit about your personal kind of growth. Are you like, what segments are you most focused on these days?
So personally, like we're mostly focused right now on industrial and land banking for potential development opportunities. But in the past, we've gone through like the condo boom in Toronto in like the early 2000s. We've also looked at the global opportunities that may be out there that we've taken advantage of here and there along the way. We've looked at commercial from office buildings that we ended up exiting right before COVID hit. So we've gone through multiple sectors. And I believe that not just diversifying from real estate and doing other things as well, but within real estate, I find the mistake that some people make and depending on what your vision and what you're trying to accomplish, I always caveat that everyone has their own goals they're trying to accomplish. It's not a one size fits all. But personally, I'm a big believer that no matter what you're, as much diversity as you can put in, if one part of the market falls, I find that you can recover from somewhere else. If you've got some equity plays and the pricing slows down, then hopefully your rentals can pick it up and so on and so forth, right? And also if you can get as much location diversity, but I know some people they want it in their backyard because they want to go see their properties. So again, it's customizing to who you are and always know your journey, right? Know what you're trying to accomplish and what your comfort zone is, because the worst mistake and one of the things that offline we talked about is, you know, the mistakes that I see people making is they'll say, well, my buddy Jim or my buddy Bob went and bought in Sault Ste. Marie or wherever, right? that doesn't mean that's the right fit for you. Yes, there might be money made, but if it gives you anxiety, keeps you awake at night, not being able to see a property, then it may not be the right venture for you. So know yourself. Always ask yourself, what are my goals? What is my comfort? And it's not just the dollar and cents. It's also your personality has to be factored into your real estate investing decisions.
Yeah. And often I think it's, now that I know many lawyers, I think it's changed my perspective. But going into this, you often think lawyers are very cold and they're not considering those things. But really good lawyers, and I can hear it in what you're saying there, are very much dependent on relationship, getting to know the person, getting to know their objectives. Just like accountants, same thing, right? There's often this perception of the accountant is just all they care about is the number, the bottom line. But there is a human element. Add on top of that, the fact that you're investing in real estate and familiar with various aspects of it. And we're going to get into, just for our audiences, just for your sake, to fill everybody in, we're going to be getting into structures, different pitfalls. I'm curious about all these things, whether you're just starting out or growing, and really talking a little bit about that. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, I'm getting the sense that you have a different way of communicating with your clients. I'm curious, what does that dynamic look like on a day-to-day, transactionally, relationally? How do you kind of balance those things?
So honestly, it depends on the personality, right? Generally, I like to be very friendly and informal in my approach. Like, my law firm is not suits and, you know, wingtips. That's not who we are. We're your average Joe who wants to invest, wants to succeed, and wants to see other people succeed. We keep our overheads low. We focus on just giving honest, candid advice. My clients, you could ask any one of them. They know that if they need me, especially if you're a repeat client, you'll have my cell phone number. I had a client literally email me at 10 o'clock last night saying, I want to buy a wholesale property. I need you to review some clauses for me. He had his response by 11 o'clock that night, and he had his full agreement reviewed by 8 a.m. this morning for him to be able to put in his offer by 10 o'clock today. So that's my approach, right? My approach is, I will talk to you, and depending on your personality, I can be very blunt, because I believe that me sugarcoating it and not giving you the best advice is not really me giving you any advice. I might as well just say, I'm not the right fit for you. But I believe that if I think you're making a mistake or you're making irresponsible decisions, I have no problem. Like, I have one client who is extremely successful, but he takes on deals with no way of how he's going to finance them, for example. And part of it is having that discussion, having a come to Jesus moment, so to speak, whereby you're saying, like, hey, how are you doing this? How are you funding this? Yes, you always figure it out, but eventually there's going to come that one deal where you won't figure it out. Flying by the seat of your pants is not a strategy to succeed in real estate investing, because the numbers of what you're talking about are not small. You know, and especially when you have families and then you have kids, and as your situation changes, your risk tolerance also should be adjusted to that. What worked for you in your early 20s and 30s when you were a hustler and you had no other commitments, that's awesome, that's great. But that doesn't necessarily work in your mid 30s and 40s when you got two kids and you're thinking about, do I have private school? Do they put them in hockey? What do I do? All these things cost money. So you can't afford to be taking that much risk, because if something goes wrong, you got to make sure, what's my fallback? You know, you have to always be thinking about that other side of things.
Yeah, and I'm a little weird in that I like the idea of kind of planning and knowing what are my next 10 steps ahead, which can actually work against you in some ways. But I do know there's a lot of people will just kind of watch what we're doing, or watch what what some of the investors on our show do. And they'll say, you know what, I like that, I'm going to just do that, I'm going to copy them. But they don't actually see what's going on in the back end strategically, why it works for us and the ways that we're protecting ourselves legally. So I would say to anyone who doesn't have a lawyer that wants to scale your portfolio, even if it's just one property, I would recommend reaching out to a lawyer. Hussein's a good pick. He's definitely savvy. You're gonna hear through the show today some of those concepts that were that I mentioned earlier. And just have someone you can pick up the phone, make a phone call, and let them be involved in each step. I know you're a big advocate on having someone be involved with their lawyer even earlier than once the agreement of purchase and sale is done. So, and I agree. I think it's good to have that conversation throughout with all of these key players. So, let's talk about some common mistakes that you've seen. I'm curious, what are some big ones as it relates to investors that, and I know you've got some doozies for us.
I mean, honestly, I've seen some common mistakes. It's about, like, not having an assignment clause, which I find is terrible because you never know. Again, it's about planning, right? You never know what the market will be. You might just have a better opportunity. In fact, this is the most common scenario I've seen is client A decides they're going to buy property one. And now they see between the time for they entered agreement and the closing date, oh, property two has come up and I can make X on property two, way more attractive than property one, but I don't have the money to close both. Now, if you don't have an assignment clause, it's much trickier because if a seller is not willing to play ball, and generally sellers, realtors, I mean, not to disparage realtors in any way, but a realtor who's acting for a seller is not going to be too happy when they suddenly get a request for an assignment when they realize now that this guy's got it. Because how do they explain to their client they didn't get them the best dollar, right? It's an awkward conversation to have.
Right.
Not that many people want to have, right? So it's about making sure you negotiate that assignment clause right away. A second thing that I want to make is making sure that you get your agreements to your lawyer on time. For example, if you're purchasing a condo or you're purchasing a new build, take advantage of that 10-day review cooling off period, because you never know what someone who's trained to look for in these agreements might pick out to make your life that little bit better. It's a nominal cost. Some lawyers don't even charge for that kind of review, depending on the scope you need. And it gives you that peace of mind. You're building that relationship in. So that's another thing that I see as a mistake. The third is that people go and enter into agreements, and I see that, oh, they've entered agreement in their personal name, or they've put it in the name of a corp, but there's no actual strategy. There's no actual, okay, hold on, why am I doing it this way? What am I working towards? So always have a mind and structure, like, how do I want to hold this property? Is it going to be short-term? Is it going to be long-term? Where do I need to go with this, right? Another one is, if you know it's a flip, but you need to get some permits and things like that, negotiate it into your APS. Start doing that before closing, if you can, because your carrying costs are going to kill your profit line. Yes, you still make money, but why leave money on the table that you don't need to if you've just effectively planned it? And yeah, so I mean, those are just some of the ones, but I mean, we could be here for all day, you know.
And I know you're going to come up. I guess I'll leave it open. If you think of another pitfall along the way, please add them in, because those are fantastic. I love the assignment one. That could be applied to anyone, not even just investors. I love that. I think that's very clever. Nowadays, with financing as challenging as it is, more and more on our agreements, we're having opportunity to add names in order to close those deals. But why not go the whole way? Why not make it assignable? And to also respond on the real estate side.
That just came up actually is on JVs. I see a lot of people are doing JVs nowadays, but they negotiate their JV agreement after they've closed the deal.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it can become very contentious because especially if you're the guy going on title and you're the one carrying the mortgage, you've almost given up all your leverage. Because now what's incentive to, you know, if you're carrying and everything else, the other party doesn't have to do that. And if you're doing JVs, create a specific bank account per JV. So there's a clear money trail, there's a clear accountability, and have all the partners required to sign. That way you avoid a whole bunch of conflict, because I promise you, whatever you're going to pay to get this set up, it's going to pale in comparison to what litigation may cost you.
So when you say per JV, are you saying per property within a JV? Or if we have a JV that has three properties, one bank account would be okay for that?
If you're doing it through a corporation, yep, then one bank account is satisfactory. If you're going to be doing it personally with, you know, one partner or even the same partner through multiple properties, even that, I recommend doing it through separate bank accounts, because then you can clearly say, this was the money, this is the paper trail specifically for this, specifically for this, specifically for this. Even with the JV agreement, you can obviously do it, and some people prefer to do just one JV for all their properties. I prefer to do it per property, because you might want to get rid of one, and having to then redo that agreement,
right,
ends up costing more. Some people think, you know, they're saving money. But really, if you think about it from the back end, and you know, from as a lawyer, having seen how the process tends to work itself out, it's just not the case. Like, it ends up costing you more.
That's a very good point. That's actually a very good point. All these changes and amendments that would come up. I mean, I'm even thinking about a property we were looking at where we have two units side by side. They're attached. You wouldn't know that they're two buildings, but they're separately legally. And the idea was to put them into two separate corporations for those ideas. But in that scenario, what you just described, if we put them under one JV, then what a nightmare it would be to separate slash sever one of the properties. So there's definitely a benefit of having them as distinct properties, despite from appearance it being on a single one. It's great. Do you find corporations are the best medium of doing these joint ventures? Or let's actually also go outside of joint ventures. If I'm just looking to scale a portfolio, maybe I've got a dream of owning 3-5 properties in the next 5 years. What would a typical investor want to do to structure that?
Honestly, there are a lot of questions that come into it. And it goes back to what I said initially, where one size doesn't fit all. And one of the things I would look at is, what's the family dynamic? And how long do you intend to hold the properties? Those are two of my first questions I always ask. Then going on a larger, speaking almost a little bit with a broad paintbrush, I recommend that if you want to build a portfolio, having a corporation, even if you need to close on them personally initially, simply to be able to qualify for financing, then setting up trust declarations, again, get a lawyer who knows what they're doing. So it's all above board. And then when you can qualify, and because then you can declare the rents and everything still through the corporation, you build up the history, then you can do what are known as nil transfers to move the property from trustee to beneficial owner. So you don't have to pay land transfer tax twice. The benefit is it frees you up. Now you can buy more because you're getting rid of these properties from your personal credit bureau. So therefore, but you need that corporate. You can't say, I'm going to set up the corporation down the line, save some money now, because that corporation needs to have existed at the date you closed on that property to effectively take advantage of the trust declaration and those options for the CRA to approve it. And that's a huge benefit you can have, is by taking aside and freeing up some capital there. Secondly, with a corporation, it's also a lot easier in terms of, you know, getting rid of JVs and things, because then you don't need to trigger land transfer or anything. If you're making JV changes, you can simply exchange the shares. Yes, there's capital gains and all that that accountants would be more than happy to talk to you about. But at the same, at least you don't have to do anything on the land side, because the corporation still owns the property. Even if you want to convey the property, you can convey it by just selling the shares of the corporation. There's a lot more flexibility that a corporation offers. It's not just about taxes, and because truly, like corporation, I mean, there's some tax benefit depending on your overall situation, but purely looking from a tax perspective is a fallacy, because you need to be looking at it from a liability protection. You need to look at it from a planning perspective. And most importantly, if you're an investor, your best friend is flexibility. If you don't have flexibility, you're giving up your best friend. Why would you do that?
Yeah. There's a lot in there. I don't even know what question to ask, because you just hit out so many things on that one point. But I absolutely know, I get what you're saying. Like, think about it. So I love your concept of doing that nil transfer. I think that's a stroke of genius. I also, I think a lot of people don't realize that, let's say you purchase in a corporation, you can sell, like you said, sell the shares of that corporation. And now you're avoiding, again, land transfer tax. Yeah, there's taxes associated, but as you mentioned, it's just one element. There's so many elements and factors to keep in mind here. You can have a partner come involved. You can bring family in later down the road, whatever. And so this ability to move it around, I think, is really clever. And absolutely, it comes down to what's your strategy, right? What's the strategy? So do you tend to find, I guess, trust agreements allow you that kind of flexibility on movement of the transfer tax?
And you can also incorporate your trust agreement into your JV agreement. You can make it one agreement that's dual. So if you have an effective lawyer drafting the agreement, you can capture it all within one agreement. And, you know, then you have that peace of mind that my eggs are where they need to be.
Yeah. Awesome. So as far as due diligence on a property, right? So I've got a JV partner, or again, maybe I don't. Maybe it's just me, my spouse. We want to go buy a property. We've got the ability to qualify, or we set up a corporation, whatever. What should I be looking at the property? I know we're going to get you or our lawyer involved early on, but what are some key things? Again, maybe there's pitfalls in there. What are some things that we should be paying attention to?
So one, in this market, having an inspection clause is a problem. And sometimes financing can also mean that you lose out on deals. Yeah. Try and get yourself pre-approved with a mortgage broker or your bank. That's one of the things. It may not be directly due diligence, but it's really important to know what you can afford so there are no surprises later on.
Is that the most common reason properties don't close, is financing? Is that a fair
Honestly, what I've been seeing lately is because the property prices have been going crazy, right? Especially in like the Halton region, is I've had multiple deals where, because also appraisers are so backed up, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
So you're not getting the appraisal till about 3-4 days before closing. And if the appraisal doesn't hit that number, suddenly you're getting a lot less money from the bank, especially if you're working with B lenders. A lenders, you don't see this as much because they pre-approve and they're a little bit more efficient. But B lenders, I've seen people have, literally, I had one client who had a deal canceled the night before it was due to close. I just got a notification from the lender saying, you know what, deal canceled. We're not funding this because the appraisal didn't come in.
Even in a, we saw that last year. It was a really big issue. People buying and then they hadn't even sold yet. That's another risk that I think people take. But the issue with those appraisals was the values were coming in lower. Don't we find with the values growing, that's not a problem? Or are people speculating so hard at the offer presentation, they're still getting caught?
I think people, there are still people speculating.
They're playing games, yeah.
You know, which is, I mean, take your risk, but know that this is a problem, you know? And also relating to that, like part of the due diligence is also when you, ideally, if you're going to be buying and selling, and you're going to be doing it on the same day and you don't want a bridge loan, understand one thing very, very clear. For your sale, talk to the buyer. See who, get a sense of their financing situation. Because remember, your lawyer, your mortgage broker could do everything perfectly. But if the person buying your home and you need that those funds to close on your purchase are going to be delayed and it's going to go into the afternoon, there's a strong possibility you're not going to be able to close.
Mm.
And if you're going to be doing buying and selling on the same day, never do it on a Friday.
You sound like me. What would you recommend as a good lag time? Actually, mention why not Fridays.
Well, simply because do you want to be homeless?
Friday's the day of the homeless.
Yeah, because if your sale closes, right? If they tender on you at 4 p.m. on a Friday, right? There's absolutely no way your purchase is going to close. Maybe if you're lucky and the seller of the house you're purchasing, their lawyer decides to be reasonable and helpful, they might agree to close in escrow, assuming that you can get it by 6 o'clock.
Not to mention you have a moving company for coming for you on Saturday.
all things like, you know, you have your internet guy coming on Saturday. You have all these things happening, yeah. Right? All of it now is going to be, you have to reschedule, rebook. And we all know, like even just getting a Kojiko or Rogers or whoever to come in, it takes time. There's lag time for everything, right? So do it on a weekday. So even if it's delayed, it's a one day thing. You have to get a hotel. You can park your moving truck. It can be managed. Weekends become a lot harder. Ideally, bridge loan it. It's not that expensive with interest rates at historical lows. Take two business days. It's not a lot you need to bridge loan. But that peace of mind you will generate yourself is going to be tremendous for you. Now, it's not perfect because still things can go wrong in real estate deals, but at least you're not planning for success. You're taking factors into your control. And I'm a big believer, control your own destiny. That's something I really believe in.
My philosophy has always been Thursday and Monday. Those are the 2 days that I tend to work with. And typically I encourage them to avoid end of month for moving costs, and lawyers tend to be busy at the beginning and the end of the month. So that's just kind of been the way that I've run it. And in fact, if you could do a Wednesday, that's even better, kind of getting a midweek thing. But okay, let's move along. So you're planning destiny, but we also need to have, we have family, we have responsibilities. A lot of our investors are our parents. What are some things we can do at the beginning, at the forefront for this succession planning of our business and for our estate planning for our heirs? What are some common conversations you have with clients?
Well, two things that come to mind. The first is, and again, this goes back to why holding property in a corporation can be the right option and often is that if you own a property through a corporation, especially if you view it as a long-term hold, you can put, corporations can be used in what is known as a secondary or a corporate will. If your real estate is owned personally, unless the first time dealings exemption applies, which is beyond the scope of this discussion, you will have to submit that property to what is colloquially known as probate, but otherwise known as estate administration. Estate administration triggers a 1.5% tax on the value, on the net value of those assets. Why would you pay, especially with real estate prices being what they are today, why would you want to pay that if you can own it through a corporation and be exempt from paying the estate administration tax? And again, that requires you to prepare a primary and a secondary will, and has a few, undoubtedly has higher upfront legal costs. No one's pretending that it doesn't, but the savings associated with having a properly drafted primary and secondary will are enormous. Like for most people who own more than one property, investment property, the savings will pay for itself right off the bat. But the day you leave a lawyer's office with your will, it will already have paid for itself by what you've saved in down the line and paying to the government. So be smart. Like, don't just think like, oh, well, I have to pay this right now. I don't want to pay it right now. What, you want to pay more later? It doesn't make sense. So that's one of the first things I want to talk about is just about making sure a real estate investor who has a corporation has a primary and a secondary will in place.
The secondary will, is that on yourself personally, or that secondary will be your corporate will?
It's also known as your corporate will. It's corporate. Just they're referred to as different things.
Okay.
Secondary estate, secondary will, corporate will. They have dual wills. It's all.
So you purchase one property in one corporation, you still recommend corporate will from the beginning.
Well, think about it this way, right? Like if you've got, say you buy a property, right? If you're going to own it for 10 years, chances are you might have $300,000-$400,000 in equity in there, right? If you're going to be doing that and you, by putting your secondary will, you're saving that 1.5% tax, right? 1.5% on $300,000-$400,000 equity, you're looking at about $3,000-$4,000, give or take. Doing a primary and a secondary will all in is maximum, it's going to cost you on the highest end is going to be $2,500 to $3,000. So already, and then you can also move all your other personal assets and everything into that secondary will. That's why I don't like calling it a corporate will. There's other stuff you can move in with a good lawyer who strategically drafts it, can move all that in. So by the time it's all said and done, you've saved yourself tremendous amounts of money, right? That, you know what, you, it's literally, you could, my joke with clients with young children is I just said, you just created your Disney World fund.
you're making law fun again, Hussein. You're making this all fun. As soon as you start talking about, oh, this thing, make this much money and save this much money. That's what gets me excited. Same with accounting, boring until you start talking about saving and making money. Then it's like, okay, you have a good line of work.
If you have a lawyer who takes an interest in you, right? Their whole goal is how to make your life better. Yeah. Because if they're making your life better, they're going to retain your services. Like you're going to retain their services and you'll be inclined to recommend them. If you just had a boring vanilla experience with a lawyer, oh yeah, I went to his office, I signed some papers, I closed the deal, and that was your extent of your experience with them, you're not going to be motivated to refer them or guide them, you know, to send them more business. But if you felt like, oh, this guy took an interest, he was happy for me, he gave me some great advice, I got to actually talk to the lawyer and not just 100%. Like, obviously, you're going to deal with a law clerk because just as an economies of scale thing, it's natural. But at least on the sign up, I had an opportunity to ask any questions through the lawyer. Like for me, if you're buying a real estate deal and when you go to sign your documents, the lawyer is not the person there, ask yourself, does this lawyer really value my business?
Okay, I'm going to hit you with a little bit of a, we're going to start wrapping up, but I want to hit you with a little bit of just your thoughts on a few things. We're kind of talking about these things, I'm curious, what's your perspective on them for people investing? Is it something you should shy away from? Is there opportunities? Kind of what is the legal, which one, I guess, comes with the highest legal burden? I'm thinking assignments. So if someone wants to get involved in assignments, pre-construction, and power of sale or foreclosures, bank sales. Are these deals that people should be looking at? Or I guess you can even do tax sales. That's another one a lot of people don't think of. Are these deals that are better to shy away from, or do you see them as opportunities and not so much of a concern on the legal front?
100%, they're opportunities. But again, do your due diligence. If you've never done one, either make sure you're partnering up with a team that has done them or a JV partner who has experience. You will not need them forever, but at least learn from people who have experience. And that's the whole point of these kinds of podcasts and real estate groups on social media and things like that, is you can reach out to people. But again, be careful who you're getting information from. Make sure they're qualified to give you that advice. Verify, and especially people who are in regulated industries where there's accountability for if they mislead you, that is, those people have something to lose by giving you bad advice. So make sure that you know who you're taking advice from. Like people on your Facebook group may have awesome advice to offer, but they also have nothing to lose. So always take it with a pinch of salt, because if you end up getting screwed on their advice, you don't have any recourse to them.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. I love that. Guys, hopefully you learned some stuff from Hussein today, and feel free to leave comments down below. I know Hussein's obviously very available, and a lot of our guests I come on that have these types of topics, oftentimes people are looking for quote unquote free legal advice, which you're not going to get the full scoop, but absolutely questions are welcome and will be responded to. And if you haven't already, please leave an iTunes review. You can share this. If you learned some stuff on IG, you can tag us at Watson Estates. Hussein, how can people find you on social media?
So actually, I don't really have a lot of social media presence professionally, but if people want to get a hold of me, they can go on my website at hsklawfirm.ca, or they can just send me an email at hkudrati@hsklawfirm.ca.
Fantastic. This has been a good chat. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we'll see you next time.
Awesome. Thanks, Bradley.